Welcome to Historically Thinking, a podcast about history and how to think about history. For more on this episode, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can find links and readings related to today's podcast, comment on the conversation, and sign up for our newsletter. And consider becoming a member of the Historically Thinking Common Room, a community of Patreon supporters. Hello. In late July 2013, Vladimir Putin visited Kyiv. There he celebrated the 1,025th anniversary of Christianity coming to the Kievan Rus. There he and Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych stood shoulder to shoulder and celebrated the unity of Russia and Ukraine. At that moment, as my guest Michael Kimmage writes, Putin and Yanukovych, Russia and Ukraine, seemed to be twin protagonists of the same story. 7 months later, things were very different indeed. This was because of what my guest, Michael Kimmage, describes as a series of collisions which resulted in the war that began in 2014, which accelerated with the invasion of 2022. The first collision was between Russia and Ukraine, the second between Russia and Europe, and the third between Russia and the United States. Michael Kimmage is professor of history at the Catholic University of America, where he's also chair of the Department of History. From 2014 to 2016, he served on the Secretary's policy planning staff at the U.S. Department of State, where he held the Russia-Ukraine portfolio. He was last on Historically Thinking in episode 165 to discuss his book, The Abandonment of the West, The History of an Idea in American Foreign Policy. His most recent book is Collisions, The Origins of the War in Ukraine and the New Global Instability, and is the subject of our conversation today. Welcome, Michael Kimmage. Welcome back to Historically Thinking.
So nice to be back here on your show.
So where do you begin the narrative and why do you begin there?
You know, it's a narrative that could be begun in many places. You could go extravagantly back to the 17th century and to a moment of unification between Russia and Ukraine. Then you could go back to 1917 and the Bolshevik Revolution. You could certainly go back to the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. And start to speculate about why it is that we are where we are. I begin in 2008, in part because it's a long book as it is, and it wouldn't be a better book if it were a longer one. But also for me, 2008 is the moment when the wars of 2014 and 2022 are not inevitable. You have Barack Obama elected in November of 2008. You have Dmitry Medvedev, who becomes the president of Russia in the spring of 2008, and these were two, you know, young, somewhat like-minded figures who had a great deal of personal affinity for one another. They were both trained as lawyers. And I think when they looked at the world, you don't see an especially conflictual, set of relationships. At that time, Medvedev is speaking positively about Russia's integration into Europe. Medvedev is trying to build a Silicon Valley in Russia, which he called Skolkovo, outside of Moscow. And Barack Obama, thinks that Russia's integration into Europe is fully possible. And when he looks at the problems in the world, you know, Russia is very far from the top of the list. In fact, it may not have been on the list at all. So I think it is important to understand why something happens by going back to the time when it's not predestined for it to happen, when it's not on the verge of happening, when it's not on the eve of happening. And then, in a sense, to get to that moment where things really begin to fall into place. And so in that sense, 2008, that sort of relatively optimistic, forward-looking integrationist moment for Russia and the United States alike, I think is the ideal place to begin.
Okay. I was thinking about this, and I want to push back a little bit on that, because it's an interesting that you tried it 2008, because that captures two of the protagonists in the three collisions. So that's a nice place to begin. However, and of course, we know from the now infamous remark in the 2012 debates that Russia was not front of mind in the Obama administration. This is the danger of presidential quips. They're hostages to fortune. But in 2007, was it not, when Putin gave his speech to the Munich Security Conference? It was in 2004 that the Orange Revolution happened, and which, you know, I'm a historian, so I'm supposed to believe in change over time. But I'm not, I am increasingly skeptical of Putin, how much Putin has changed. I think his power has changed. I'm not sure. I'm not sure his ideas have changed at all. But certainly, in many ways, it seems to me the Orange Revolution radicalized Vladimir Putin. He had tried to poison the liberal alternative with dioxin or something like that. I mean, someone did it, and I don't think it was, you know, it was most likely it was the whoever the KGB calls themselves now. So why not 2004? Because it seems to me, I mean, what is very clear, and we'll get to this in a second, what's very clear is in the years prior to that, that in some ways, Ukrainian independence was a surprise to everybody, maybe especially to the Ukrainians. And they were, and there was a series of leaders that were pleased to muddle along in some sort of subsidiary relationship, but that 2004 broke that. So why not 2004 rather than 2008?
Sure, that's a great question. And it points to some of the most important debates about, really about Russia, I would say maybe a little bit less so about the United States, but, you know, is Putin all the way through? Is he readying himself for 2014 and 2022 already when he first comes to the presidency? And in a way, it's a broader question than that. Russia's view of its neighbors does vary between the will to dominate, the will to influence, the will to manipulate, and that is a subject that goes far beyond the figure of Vladimir Putin. Takes us back to Yeltsin and Gorbachev in some ways, but more to the point, back to very, very large and entrenched patterns in Russian history and foreign policy. So the book deals with this problem in the following way. Chapter 2 is titled The Allure of a Modern Russia, and Chapter 3 is entitled The Dilemma of the Modern Russia, of a Modern Russia. And these two chapters go back and forth with the same time period. So it is the case that a lot of the seeds of what's going to happen later are planted when Putin comes to power. What Putin does is gradually build Russia into a dictatorship. And that's a necessary precondition, for, certainly for the 2022 war, but maybe also for the 2014 war. And as you suggest, Putin's notion of the West, his notion of the United States, is far more embittered than Yeltsin's was and than Medvedev's would seem to be between 2008-2012, when Medvedev was the president or the seeming president of Russia. Putin is never easy for the United States to work with. The very first meetings that Bill Clinton had with Putin when he became president, you know, Clinton returns from those meetings and says, we've got something of a problem on our hands. So all of that is true. You know, all of that is there in the background. That is a kind of foundation to understand where things trend in 2011, 2012, 2013, as real tensions begin to form. But I do think that none of this until the Maidan Revolution of 2013 in Ukraine is again, inevitably pointing toward large-scale conflict. So in 2007, Putin gives the Munich Security Speech, but he also goes to Kennebunkport, Maine, to visit the Bush family compound. There's a lot of cooperation between Russia and the United States in 2007. Some of it is about arms control. Some of it is about the war in Afghanistan, which Russia did a lot to help the United States to prosecute. And some of it is just the deepening economic ties between Russia and the U.S. on the one hand and Russia and Europe on the other. So yes, you have conflict and you have the Munich Security Speech, but you also have a very, very different context. The other point that I would make in this regard is that we really don't know Putin's mind, and it's entirely possible that the Putin that we see today is the Putin we've always had. But it didn't appear that way in Washington, and we need to understand why Washington had a kind of optimism about Russia that really did structure American foreign policy. Now that, again, we can in retrospect say that that was an illusion or that was naive, but the optimism was there. And it's, you know, very much the case that between 2008 and 2012, even though Russia had invaded Georgia in August of 2008, you know, 2-3 months before the presidential election in the U.S., and that's, of course, Medvedev who was in power then, even with that, the U.S. felt that there was a bright future to the U.S.-Russian relationship, and you know that Medvedev was saying many of the right things and perhaps even doing many of the right things. So, you know, as a historian, I'm fully comfortable with there being multiple realities and some push in some directions, some push in different directions. But I also want to emphasize to my readers the reality that the White House saw and the reality that the White House used to chart its course, and that was an optimistic one.
So this points out several of the problems of writing a contemporary history. I think I'm right in saying that this is the closest thing to sort of history torn from the headlines that you have ever written. This is as close to the present moment as you've gotten. And I remember a professor of mine, Mac Walker, eminent historian of Germany. This was in 88. I was a freshman. And Walker, he refused to go beyond, I think, the Berlin crisis and the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. Because after that, he said, it was just getting too close. He was too much, at least an observer participant. And he had too many opinions, which probably were in error. When I taught the survey, I tried to follow that. I would usually stop about taking a cue from him. I'd stop about 25 years before the moment I was giving the final lecture, basically. Which is nice. It's kind of set up tension. No, of course, some of them knew what happened next. So, but if you could bring it to show that what happened next wasn't necessarily foreordained, that's always nice. But to write within that 25 years, that has certain challenges. You've alluded to one, which is what you refer to in the book as the black box of Putin's mind. We just don't know what he's thinking. We might never know what he was thinking, even in 50 years when there's a nice progressive liberal administration in Russia. It's a bastion of human rights and cultural ferment. When in this alternate reality, you can read the archives of the Kremlin and Putin's era, we still might not know what he thinks.
Right.
But what are some, in addition to that, what are some other problems of writing a contemporary history like this?
No, that for sure. The problem of evidence is a big one. It's, of course, significant on the U.S. side as well. It will be probably 20, 30 years before the documentary basis of U.S. decision-making is released. And I think that would be the same for, most of the European governments that are important, and Ukrainian archives as well. I don't know the status of that at the moment, but for a country in wartime to open its archives on matters of national security, they're going to be very reluctant to do that for a long time to come. So there's evidence. There's another intellectual problem, philosophical problem, is that we don't know how the war is going to end. And on a certain level, you can say the question of the war's origins is disconnected from the question of the war's termination, because you could speculate accurately about the war's origins even before you know how it ends. But to tell the story of a war, you do need to know how it ends. The First World War, if Germany had won the First World War, I think we would probably conceive of the origins of the First World War differently. And if Japan had won the Second World War, you can make the same kind of argument. So I don't know how to overcome that problem. You can't. It's one that you just have to acknowledge. But in narrative terms, and I see this now with a lot of other books that I read about the war in Ukraine, the 2022 war, and I think my book does this a little bit too, is that we exaggerate the importance of Ukraine's military victories in 2022. They were important, and they made a huge impression on all of us at the time, but actually they've proven to be a bit more transient than I would have thought. And there, too, you can sort of see analytical problems. The other, and the final point that I'll make on this subject, the other problem is the one that you yourself describe, which is that we are witnesses, we are observers, we have opinions, we're citizens, and we don't look with neutrality, nor should we, at a terrible war of this kind. And so it's very difficult to kind of keep that in check and to write adequately about decision-making, to be adequately critical of figures on the side that you're rooting for. That's all a huge problem. But I did make an appeal, Al, to a very illustrious historian predecessor in this regard, and this was Thucydides, who wrote, I think what we would all agree, is one of the world's greatest books on war, but also one of the greatest works of history. Thucydides was a general in the Athenian army, and he writes the history of the Peloponnesian War before the war itself is over. And, it's debated how neutral he was, that he may have, not been quite as objective as his prose style would suggest, but I think his achievement in that regard is extraordinary. And what he shows us is that it's at least possible. Other historians are going to come and do it better, but it's at least possible to to get the ball of history writing moving, even when the events are not yet in a state of conclusion.
Yeah, I should think that people who read this are going to have they're going to think in the way that we now think about politics in America and elsewhere. So I'm reliably informed. They're going to be looking for their guys and the bad guys. Trump supporters are going to be disgusted. Well, if they read the book, they'd be disgusted by what you say about Obama. Many more Obama supporters are going to read the book, perhaps, and they're going to be disgusted by your even-handedness. I think very judicial even-handedness with trying to describe what exactly happened during the Trump administration. So I think congratulations. I think everyone will be upset with you.
That's good. If it's the case, it's very hard. I mean, this is a larger problem with writing works of history. It's very hard not to preach to the choir, which is a huge problem of writing something so close to the present moment in real time with readers who are all living through it in their own way with their opinions and their thoughts. I do think that history, there's a sort of utopian possibility in historical writing that's very important here. And first is to slow down. So newspaper articles, 1,500 words, 2,000 words at most, are going to take you through a subject rapidly. But what historical writing does is to slow the process down. Even going back to 2008 or further back into the past slows things down. It sort of slows the mind down. So the partisan mind is a little bit less able to function with that condition of slowness. But I think the greatest works of history sort of balance evidence and have that balanced approach to evidence. And that is, of course, much easier to achieve after the fact. But it's a pleasure to try and to aspire to that. And I know that I'm going to fail for the most part. But the effort to try, I feel, is useful, especially with an event like this, which is so emotional, to slow it down and to be analytical rather than to be partisan and emotive.
That's a very – we should probably have a whole podcast on slow history.
Yes.
I just heard someone using – based off of slow food, was talking about slow productivity. Some excellent observations. And it strikes me this is actually perhaps the true offensiveness of this book and of history in this moment. It's not simply that partisans need to be faster. The partisanship of our moment in combination with our technology requires things to be faster. It requires the amygdala to be white hot. If your amygdala is not white hot, you don't really care. Yes. You're not paying attention. And so this is the way in which doing a work of history like this is offensive and countercultural.
I hope so. I mean, I think that the way most of us experience the war, this is certainly true for me, is through social media. And there are lots of good things to say about social media and this particular war. There are excellent journalists out there operating on the ground in Ukraine who you're not going to read if you would only read the Washington Post, the New York Times, Wall Street Journal.
That's right.
You're not going to get
and analysts. I mean, I've discovered Mick Ryan. I've discovered Phillips P. O'Brien. Sure. I mean, people like that. Trent Taleiko, former defense logistics specialist, who explained the importance of rotating your tires in a truck depot.
That famous thread, yeah.
Which was like brilliant because logistics are life. Explained everything about what was not going right with the invasion. I mean, it's so. You know, Twitter has been wonderful in the early stages for finding people to read their books, actually.
Sure. It's a great intellectual enrichment, but it's also unbelievably seductive in a way, social media. And it's impossible not to look. And the speed of it is fantastic because you can get news really on the hour from what's happening on the battlefield, and you can get good quality interpretation of it. But what you also get for the most part on social media is a highly emotive way of thinking that is chained to the present moment. And so you get brilliant analysis of March 11th in the early morning hours, and then 3 days later it's obsolete and you're sort of moved on to the next moment of brilliant analysis. And, of course, you have all of the polemics and efforts to manipulate the truth that are typical of wartime but now happen at warp speed on social media. So the job of historians, I think, I would say, Al, is to get involved. And you have a wonderful book on the war by Serhiy Plokhy, a Harvard historian of Ukraine, the Russo-Ukrainian War, which is a great guide to anybody trying to understand, especially the regional dynamics of this war and the Russo-Ukrainian dynamics of this war. And we just need more of that. Even if we all fail at it in one way or another, we just need more of that methodical, somewhat plodding effort to put this in context, and to see that this war, which is steeped in history at every turn, you know, the ways in which the various countries use history is a very remarkable feature of this war. There's such a huge historical component, and it's crucial for us to begin to learn how to think about this war as an event in history with a strong element of the past to it, in part because the present moment is buzzing with so much, you know, sort of energy and activity. I've never felt the utility, the value, and the virtue of history quite as much as I do at the present moment.
Well, I want to talk about the book by touching on the three collisions that you write about and which I mentioned in the intro. The first is between Russia and Ukraine. And it is, you've alluded to this already, but it's very striking to me that in many ways, as the anecdote I gave in the intro suggests, in July 2013, you would not have expected, just looking at those events, it would be hard to then expect what happened by February 2014. So is this collision recent or old? And this gets into, this is very contested because in many ways, Vladimir Putin is killing Ukrainians because he said, we've always been one. You know, there is no contest. There is no collision. We've always been one. So therefore, it's Nazis and perverts who have seduced you. And I will kill you until you love me, again, as you should. I can see a Ukrainian nationalist wants to say we've never been one. And of course, we've never been together. Ukraine has nothing to do with Russia. Of course, there must be, the truth must be somewhere in the vast range between those two perspectives.
Yes. And your focus on the summer of 2013 is, I think, highly instructive in that regard. I think there's nothing more mysterious in politics than revolution. To me, it's the same with the American Revolution, French Revolution, Russian Revolution. They all seem in a certain way when they happen to come from nowhere. It's difficult to understand how you can have a country in peace 1 month and then exploding with revolutionary fervor a few months later. But this does, you know, shed an important light on Ukraine's relationship to Russia, which is a huge topic and extremely fraught and full of polemical zeal on both sides, you could say, although the polemical zeal on the Russian side is more consequential because it's what Putin himself believes. These are, you know, sort of peoples and cultures that are in close proximity, you know, neighboring peoples, neighboring cultures, and there is a considerable amount of overlap, and you can point to all of the ways in which both Ukrainians and Ukrainian culture have influenced Imperial Russia, the Soviet Union, and post-Soviet Russia. If you look at a lot of the names in the Kremlin, they're in fact Ukrainian names, and it's a fact of life on both sides of the border that millions of Russian families have Ukrainian relatives, and of course on the other side, millions of Ukrainian families have Russian relatives. In the Soviet Union, you know, Khrushchev is not quite Ukrainian, but has roots in the region, spent a lot of his early career in Ukraine. You know, Brezhnev sort of stylized himself as a Ukrainian. Gorbachev, I think, had two Ukrainian grandparents. I think Raisa, even more Ukrainian heritage. And, you know, you can kind of go on and on with that. So there's the intertwining, which is important. And certain elements of overlap that go through language and religion, Orthodox Christianity. And, you know, we could talk for hours about how the two cultures and the two peoples are connected, not in the way that Putin alleges, but in a way that has more historical validity. And at the same time, there is certainly a distinctive sense of Ukrainianness. And there is, in the late 19th century, a striving for an independent Ukrainian nation. You see that all across Eastern and Central Europe in those years. It doesn't pan out for Ukraine in 1919. You know, Ukraine tries to send delegates to the Treaty of Versailles and to the structure that's being built for Europe in 1919. Poland succeeds and they get an independent Poland. Ukraine does not. After the First World War, Ukrainian territory is divided between an independent Poland and the Soviet Union. And then in 1991, very consequentially, Ukraine does achieve nationhood And not all of that nationhood is counterposed to Russia or anti-Russian after 1991. There's a huge amount of back and forth, but it does develop and strengthen. And some of it is nationalist in flavor. There is a bit of that. That's true, although that's never played a huge role in sort of electoral Ukrainian politics or high politics. In Ukraine, a lot of it is just everyday identification with the map of a country, with the flag, with the sports teams, and with the feeling of being part of a collective unit. That was maybe not fully in place in 2014 in the first phase of this conflict. It would be impossible to argue that there is not a strong sense of nationhood in Ukraine in 2022 because you just see how willing people are to fight and defend their fellow Ukrainian citizens and Ukrainian territory. So that evidence, I think, is unimpeachable. But prior to 2014, especially, there was a kind of fluidity, a possibility of going back and forth. And that's what is captured in that moment when you have Yanukovych and Putin standing at the Kiev Monastery of the Caves and sort of celebrating a common history. That might have pissed off a lot of people in Ukraine at the time. I think it did certainly anger some, but it was something that a politician could do at that point and get away with. And yet, not long thereafter, you get a revolution that's going to pull Ukraine in a very different direction.
It was certain within the realm of general plausibility in 2013 in a way that can we even imagine the changes that would be required for a Russian president to now stand side by side. Wow. I mean, it's bigger than, in some way, it's bigger than Sadat going to Jerusalem.
Absolutely.
Right now.
And what was plausible in American history, of course, not long before the revolution, was people like George Washington and Ben Franklin as aspiring professionals within the British Empire, which they certainly were, and wanted to rise up and be powerful figures within an empire. And then, a change occurs. Yes. Not only is that no longer, sort of thinkable, it's no longer desirable. And again, that brings us back to the mystery of revolution, which is at the heart of this story because of the changes that occur in Ukraine between November 2013 and February 2014.
You write that Russia's imperial purview for centuries had been fixed on Ukraine. We've had Chris Miller of Tufts on the podcast a couple times, once to talk about what he describes as the perennial Russian pivot to Asia. But it's worth remembering that when Russia is not pivoting towards the Wild East and towards the possibilities of the Pacific coast of Siberia and, the Hawaiian Islands and Alaska and, something and something with China, taking something from China, they're thinking about Ukraine. It's through Ukraine. The roads go through Ukraine to attack the Turks, to save the Bulgars, to fight the Poles, who, as we know, are responsible for World War II and most bad things that happen on the western border of Russia. Ukraine is the focus of Russian will and empire.
So, 3 points I would make here, in turn. I think helped understand the Russian purview. You described one perfectly. I mean, this is territory that is going to matter to Russia regardless of whether you have a Russian leader friendly to Europe or a Russian leader who sees Europe as a hostile force. And for the geopolitical position of Russia, geostrategic position of Russia, Ukrainian territory is pivotal. I mean, it's Black Sea, as you mentioned, and therefore Turkey, South Caucasus, Bulgaria, Romania, and these areas, and of course it's Poland, Hungary, Slovakia, and these territories also border on Ukrainian land. So there's no way in which you can have a kind of national security strategy for Russia and not be preoccupied with this bit of territory. And although Napoleon doesn't quite go through Ukraine, he goes more through Lithuania and Belarus. The Second World War certainly goes not just through Ukraine, but when Hitler thinks of Lebensraum, what he really has in mind is Ukrainian territory. So it's understandable in a way. It doesn't justify what Russia does, but it's understandable that Ukraine as territory would be of immense strategic significance to Moscow. But then what makes, I think, the whole equation much more complicated is that for Russia, Ukrainians break into two categories. You see this at the present moment, but it has huge historical pedigree, this distinction. And you could put it this way, there are good Ukrainians and there are bad Ukrainians. And the good Ukrainians are sort of a version of Russians. Maybe they're Russian speakers, maybe they are Ukrainian speakers, but at heart they're kind of, you know, a part of Russia. And Serhiy Plokhiy is a wonderful historian to deal with the articulation of this ideology or of this point of view. But in this scheme, Belarus, Russia, and Ukraine are sort of three pillars of the same structure. And so it's not even empire in this respect that would be significant. It's, you know, these places as a part of Russia. And that probably extends to Kiev, to Odessa, certainly to a city like Kharkiv in Ukraine's east, Mariupol, Chernigov in the north, et cetera. These are really understood to be Russian lands, and the people who live in these places are kind of Russian Ukrainians or Ukrainian Russians. But the bad Ukrainians also exist. This is a big part of the Russian storytelling, the Russian mythology, and these are the nationalists, especially in the West, who have been invented by the West, by Austro-Hungary, by Poland, more recently by the United States, have invented this Ukrainian nationalist juggernaut for the sake of weakening Russia. And this kind of Ukraine or these kinds of Ukrainians have to either be subdued or perhaps even extirpated, you know, sort of eliminated. You get bits of that, bits and pieces of that mentality in the current Russian occupation of Ukrainian territory. So in that sense, there's a sort of schizophrenia about Ukraine that Russia has, that it's our brothers and it's us, and at the same time, it's the enemy. And I think a lot of the contradictions in Russian behavior follow from that particular distinction.
Let's talk about the second collision, Russia versus Europe. And this seems to me, reading your book and also reading that of others and previous guests on the show, I'm thinking of our podcast on the Quiet Revolution in the 1830s, that every time Russia is obsessing with Europe from Peter the Great onwards, they're always obsessing about modernity and what it means to, what it means for Russia to be modern. That's, you know, Peter the Great going to work in a Dutch shipyard, trashing John Evelyn's country manor in endless parties and running around in wheelbarrow races. Dwarves are involved. And then coming back to cut off everyone's beards. In his way, he's obsessed about modernity and St. Peter and opening up a window to the West and blah, 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 blah. But it doesn't stop with Peter the Great. It's a recurring theme.
Sure. And I think you could dramatize this theme by saying, as I'll try to argue in a moment, that this long trend line in Russian history comes to an end in 2022. And, you know, let me try to make the point in the following way. Of course, Peter the Great is the founding figure, you know, studies at a Dutch shipyard, how to build modern ships, creates the modern city of St. Petersburg, window to the West, which he gives his name to, builds up an academy of sciences in Russia, as you say, you know, compels Russia to dress and to comport themselves differently as Westerners. And it's a modernization thrust and it's a Westernization thrust simultaneously. And that's going to be carried forward in her own way by Catherine the Great and will be one of the threads of 19th century Russian history. In a rather surreal way, the Bolsheviks kind of supercharge that topic, and they take a Western ideology, philosophy, Marxism, and they impose that on Russia. And at the same time, you have Stalin bringing over thousands of American engineers and others to kind of modernize, industrialize
Russia. Should, I mean, this goes to the third collision, but I was thinking, you know, the Bolshevik obsession with the United States as the epitome of Fordism.
Absolutely.
And the glory of industrialization, but at the same time, you know, it's arguably Stalin who comes up with the term American exceptionalism, or is it J.E. Lovestone? It's an American Communist Party leader to try to explain why is the party so bad in the States? What, because this is the United States is the black hole of the revolution. How could this be possible? It's disgusting.
Right.
It's lack of class consciousness. But at the same time, it's Fordist. It's
absolutely
the future.
And, you know, the Soviet Union was meant to supersede, you know, the achievements or the kind of industrial might of the United States. And so you get Stalin's birthday cake skyscrapers in Moscow that are, in his eyes, a kind of better version of the American skyscraper. But there is that modernization phase with Stalin. And then you get the third version of this under Yeltsin and Putin, where Russia has to adopt a market economy. sort of adjust to the new, globalized world of commerce and technology, and has to import and change a lot. Once again, dress is sort of at issue, right? The blue jeans become the uniform of Russians in the 1990s, and that signifies the arrival in a new and modern world. Rather like Peter the Great, for Putin, this was a tactical modernization or tactical imitation of the West. It's not that Putin in particular wanted Russia to become the West or even to become like the West. He wanted Russia to have the kinds of powers that the West had. Medvedev was more of an admirer. He opens his Twitter account in San Francisco in the Twitter offices, and he has a kind of a real appreciation for American style and American technology that Putin never had. But Putin is, of course, the much more important figure. And so he modernizes for the sake of military excellence, exactly as Peter the Great had. And in 2022, Putin was comfortable. This is one of the most important points you can make about this war, because it's going to outlast Putin for sure. Putin was comfortable justifying and creating an almost complete rupture with the West. So he had to know that even if he won in Ukraine in a couple of weeks, that Europe and the United States would cut off Russia for a long time with sanctions, with various forms of sort of blockading Russia, weakening Russia militarily, economically, all of which has happened. And now the wall between Russia and the West is probably deeper, thicker, stronger, higher than it was in the Cold War. The Iron Curtain was more permeable than the war that we now have between Russia and the West. And for young Russians, forget it. There's no way that they can study in the West. And, contact with Westerners is going to be difficult if it's not on social media. And Russia has really reoriented itself. I don't want to be too melodramatic and hyperbolic about this, but you have not seen this kind of reorientation in Russia for hundreds of years. And it's fascinating to watch. Very, very sad to watch, I would say. It's a great loss for Russia, and I think it's a great loss for us on our side of the wall. But there it is. And in that sense, 2022 is a collision with Europe, yes. You could also say it's a collision with Russia's own past, Russia's own modernizing and westernizing past. Now they're going to modernize more along Chinese lines or, sort of global anti-Western lines. And whether they succeed or not is anybody's guess. But it's an utterly fascinating aspect of this war.
You write that moments of lasting peace with Europe are at times when Russia's militarily ascendant.
Yes.
One of those being 1815 to 1917. We forget that Russia was occupied, the Russian army occupied Paris. Mm-hmm. And among other things, gave us the word bistro and changed French fashion. And that lasted for some time. And we also, since we don't read diplomatic history anymore, it's hard to emphasize the shock of the great, not just the Anglo-French alliance, but the French-Russian alliance prior to the First World War, between the most liberal, the Liberal Republic of France, and the most autocratic regime in Europe. But that was a time when Russia was military ascendant, and that was a time of peace.
Yes, it is a lesson that we can try to learn from history in this regard. It's not a very uplifting lesson, and it's not a very reassuring lesson, but it is a lesson. And there's a second phase to this. So you've mentioned the Congress of Europe and after the Napoleonic Wars, how Russia became really a part of the European state system and certainly a pivotal player in European diplomacy. And then you have, the Romanov dynasty is intermarried at so many points with the various dynastic families of Britain and continental Europe, such that when you get to the First World War, it's all cousins who are fighting with each other in the First World War. But Russia is an organic part of Europe in the 19th century, and its empire was never bigger. Extends to Łódź in contemporary Poland, the Baltic republics, parts of Finland, sort of large parts of Ukraine, and even parts of sort of Moldova. And that part of Europe. In 1975, you have the Helsinki Final Act, which is sort of a masterstroke of diplomacy in a number of ways between the West and Russia, West and the Soviet Union. And what you have then, we tend to concentrate on this because it tells our story of the Cold War, is that Russia or the Soviet Union commits itself to various human rights requirements. It does so cynically, but they're going to actually have a pretty big effect in the Soviet Union and the Soviet Empire. But at the same time, what the West and the Soviet Union did in 1975 is to secure Europe's borders. So, you know, it's 30 years after the Second World War comes to an end, the Soviet Union and the West can agree that these are going to be the borders of Europe. We're not going to contest them. And that was, in some respects, to concede Soviet control over East Germany, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Hungary, et cetera, not to mention the Baltic republics and Ukraine. And, you know, from 1975 until 2014, you have peace in Europe. And that, of course, is very, very important. From the Russian side, in 1991, they lose all of that control. And they are a humiliated country. They have been knocked on their back. And Putin, I don't know how all Russians see this question, but Putin very much thinks of the 2014 and 2022 wars as restorative. We are going to restore our proper role in Europe. And if Putin manages to do that, let's say he defeats Ukraine in this war and starts to take more territory, he may be very interested in forging peace with the West. I doubt that the West will be interested in forging peace with him, but he would be very interested because he would have what he wishes to have. And we can be very critical of Putin in this regard. We should be, but we need also to realize how consistent this is with Russian history.
At the same time, by April of 2022, we realized this is a time, and this is why I think this time is dangerous. Russia is not militarily ascendant. Right. And I don't think even now, despite, you know, people are apt to be very manic depressive about any war. That's one of the lessons of how wars are fought, at home, at least, is people go up and down, and there's very few, there's never a straight through line in people's emotional reaction or cognitive deliberations about conflict. But the danger is the Russian army is so damn weak. And I'm still pretty convinced the last 2 years, that especially now, that Finland, Poland, and Ukraine together could deliver a substantial defeat if the three of them were in a war by themselves with Russia. Okay, no nuclear weapons, but they're formidable military forces, and Russia is not, and that actually makes the situation more dangerous. Russia does not have a sufficient conventional deterrent to make people want to negotiate with it. And it's clear that, that Putin did not realize that about this sophisticated military machine that he believed that he was growing.
Well, I think that may well be true. I'm a little bit more agnostic about how all of this, will play itself out. But I think that your sense of proportion is largely correct, that Russia's conventional military has performed very badly in Ukraine. That's in some ways the story of the war as much as anything else, that after 2 years of frantic effort, Russia basically controls 17% of Ukrainian territory and can't take Ukraine's cities. And if it can't take Ukraine's cities, it can't win the war. So Russia has built for itself a kind of near impossible task in Ukraine. And you could go further and say that what Putin's modernization was, you know, he had those years between 2000 and 2022 to modernize Russia and make it a powerful military force. There's a lot that he left out along the way. He didn't really harness the talents of Russians to build businesses and innovate technologically and do the things that China and the United States and Europe do to varying degrees of success. And there's a lot that's sort of hollow in Russia itself, not just its military, but it's a rather hollow country in some regards. It's a dictatorship that can puff itself up and look strong, but there's a lot of weakness in the core of it. The most important piece of that weakness being what the heck is going to happen to Russia if Putin dies or just passes from the scene, when the country could descend into a kind of internal chaos. But, you know, this is a moment in the war where Ukraine is in a very tough position. The U.S. has taken itself out of the war over the last couple of months, not at the behest of the White House, but that's a fact of the situation. And Europe has been incredibly slow to make good on a lot of the promises Europe has made to Ukraine. Munitions, fighter jets, air defenses, etc. And, you know, there are ways in which this could all go very, very badly still. For Ukraine. That does not put Russian soldiers on the edge of Paris by any means, or the edge of Bratislava, or the edge of Warsaw, or of Riga or Vilnius. That's an overinterpretation. But if Russia were to triumph in Ukraine, we would be living not just in a very different Europe, we would be living in a very different world. And that's not at the moment exactly a remote possibility. It's a kind of 30% possibility, but that's, you know, it's rather daunting to contemplate.
This connects to what we describe as the third cause of the war, and it takes us to the third collision, how Europe and the United States overpromised and underdelivered.
Yes.
Really from 1991 to 2014 and then to 2022. And we still are doing it.
Yes.
We will support you as long as it takes. We won't specify necessarily how, and we'll change our mind. We'll titrate, as Elliot Cohen has said, keep on titrating how we support you. This is a continuous story of overpromising and underdelivering.
That's, I'm afraid, what the historical record kind of reflects back on us when we look in the mirror of the historical record, that the story of Western policy toward Ukraine, European and U.S. policy toward Ukraine since 1991, is a story of half steps. And there are times when half steps get you through in life or get you through in diplomacy, and they might have gotten through here if there hadn't been perhaps a revolution in Ukraine, if we didn't have Putin in charge, if, you know, you can imagine a couple of different scenarios that haven't really come to pass. But the half steps have been, prior to 2022, really tragic for Ukraine. So we'll signify that you could become a NATO member, but we're not really going to build that path for you. We'll suggest that we want you to integrate into our world, which Europe and the United States have said many times to Ukraine, but we're not going to take any responsibility for Ukrainian security. And so you end up with the worst of all possible worlds, where Russia, through its own misinterpretations, delusions, paranoia at times, imagines the West to be incorporating Ukraine into its orbit. And at the same time, there's just no wall being built or no military foundation being laid in Ukraine that could deter Russia. That's the worst of all possible worlds. You provide Russia something of a reason for going in its terms, not in ours, but in its terms, and you don't offer Ukraine enough to defend itself. Now, that did change in 2022, and what Ukraine has, even if the U.S. is not providing military aid at the moment, is targeting and intelligence coming from, you know, the world's unrivaled superpower in these regards, and there's lots of money and military aid flowing in from Europe, also from South Korea, from Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Canada. I mean, there are many, many actors in the coalition supporting Ukraine, and they're all doing a lot at the present moment. So maybe it's three-quarter steps now, but the open question is whether three-quarter steps are going to be enough, given the tenacity of Russia and Russia for all of its weaknesses and, you know, incompetence at fighting wars. You know, Russia does have capacity. And so if it's got capacity and tenacious intent, it represents a major challenge, and that challenge has to be met with a major counter response. And that's the moment that we're in right now. Is that going to happen, or is that not going to happen?
I would say it's three-quarter steps and half step backward. It's the Ukrainian shuffle. Let's talk about the collision three, the United States versus Russia. This is very much related to the third cause of the war. The fourth cause is, you write, that Putin had surveyed. This is a very, very bipartisan. He had surveyed the Bush, the Obama, the Trump, and the Biden administrations, his years of experience with all of them, and decided by 2022 that the United States was incapable of defeating Russia's ambitions. This was very much related to the overpromising and underdelivering of the third cause. But
yes, you know, so I've done this myself a moment ago, and this is a standard trope in analyzing Russia, which is to look at the question of to what degree Russia rightly or wrongly fears us. And this is the whole debate about NATO enlargement or NATO expansion, the Mearsheimer argument, that what we did, you know, going back to Thucydides, is we gave cause for fear, and fear is the cause of war. When the alignments are such that, you know, there's sort of fear of your antagonist, you want to strike first and go to war. Now, I wouldn't dismiss all of that. I think that there is an element of fear here. I don't think it was about Ukraine attacking Russia. That would have been science fiction. But the fear was of Ukraine joining over the long term with the West. And that's, you know, that is a part of the story of this war. I don't think it's a story that
we have to say, explain, though. What is that? Where's the fear there? That NATO will attack via Ukraine?
No.
What's the fear?
I don't think it's that NATO will attack. It's that you have on the Russian side, very, very key military installations, what we were talking about earlier, sort of key strategic territory, you know, from Crimea and, you know, sort of what that signifies for the Black Sea to a border. Now, I can't quite remember what the numbers are, 1,100, 1,200 kilometer border between Ukraine and Russia, and a direct path into, you know, the sort of central parts of Russia. And to allow this to sort of, in quotation marks, fall into Western hands is to set yourself up for the moment when Western leadership is no longer as benignly disposed toward Russia. And if they would be malignly disposed toward Russia, if you give this away, again, in quotation marks, what you've done is you've undermined your security for, you know, sort of Russians living in the main part of the central part of the of the country. So that's the fear that's there. But the other thread of this, which I think never gets the attention it deserves, is the contempt that Putin has for the United States and the contempt that Putin has for Europe. And it's two different kinds of contempt in both cases. The contempt that Putin has for Europe is that Europe is, you know, a rhetorical superpower. It doesn't have an army. There's no EU army. Most European countries prior to 2022 were very reluctant to invest significantly in defense. They don't really have the capacity. They can't integrate. They can't cooperate. And without the United States, Europe would be a paper tiger. And so Europe is just the puppy dog of the United States and sort of follows behind its military older brother. And so I think that fosters in Putin a kind of contempt, because when Europeans tell Putin what to do, or that what he's doing is wrong, or that you shouldn't kill Alexei Navalny, I think his response is, who are you? You know, what do you bring to the table? The famous quote of Joseph Stalin's about the Pope: how many divisions does the Pope have? I think that's sort of Putin's question about Europe. How many divisions does Europe have? Not enough to exert their will. The contempt for the United States is different because the U.S. outclasses Russia militarily in just about every category, certainly of conventional military power. But I think for Putin, and he's not, in my view, deluded on this point. I think he makes an argument that you can make. I wouldn't share all of his assessments, but his argument is that the U.S. goes into places like Iraq, it goes into places like Afghanistan, it makes dramatic and bold claims about nation building. It doesn't pan out. The public loses interest. You know, things kind of fragment in a certain way with domestic politics. And then when the moment is suitable, the U.S. will withdraw and pull back. And so I think Putin would say this is the story of Iraq, this is the story of Afghanistan, this is the story of Libya when NATO does its bombing campaign in 2011. And so if that's true for the U.S., the U.S. is a kind of occasional superpower that loses interest when things get messy and long-term, well, great. You know, if I don't do well in Ukraine in 2022 at the beginning, I'll make things messy and long-term. And at a certain point, the United States will pick up and move elsewhere. I don't think that that's happened, and I don't think that that will happen in the case of the United States, although you could configure the news at the present moment and put it into that narrative. But I think that that is Putin's outlook, and it's one based not on fear of Washington, but of contempt for Washington.
And it's also at the heart of this, the conceit of autocracy.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, every autocrat believes that he is a strategic genius. They have to. If you didn't, you couldn't continue as one. And that you can outlast. You have the vision. You can see the future. And this pointless, muddling democracy, and Putin doesn't understand it. I mean, hell, most Europeans don't seem to understand it either. I'm not sure. Many Americans, we have a difficulty understanding it. Yeah. But democracy is by design messy. It's and consensual. And therefore, it always leaves people upset with the result that they've gotten, no matter what side they're on. No one ever wins. And that it just looks so bizarre to an autocrat. It always has.
No, I couldn't agree more. I think it's a fundamental point. And I quote, as the epigraph to one of my chapters, and I can't remember which one, maybe the introduction, Alexis de Tocqueville's famous last paragraph of Democracy in America from the 1830s.
Book one. But the first volume.
First volume. Where he says that the world is going to be ruled, or at least Europe is going to be ruled at a certain point by the United States and by Russia, and it will be Anglo-Saxon liberty on one side and Russian autocracy on the other. It's a startling quote because it was constantly used during the Cold War to say, well, look, you know, Tocqueville was onto something, but there we are again, you know, sort of walking in Tocqueville's footsteps. So this intensifies the incomprehension on both sides, the extreme difference between Russian autocracy and American democracy. It's why the diplomacy is so difficult, more difficult than it was in the Cold War for reasons I don't fully understand. But Russia's autocratic nature, the dictatorship that Putin builds, is the necessary ingredient for the 2022 invasion. It might be that other Russian leaders would have done Crimea. That is really popular in Russia. That kind of works for Russia. Invasion of the Donbass in 2014, I'm not sure that sort of bears Putin's signature to me, and that was, you know, sort of a mess from the beginning and is still a mess. I don't think most Russian leaders would have done the 2022 war. And I also think, although this is not something that I have evidence for, nor I think could one really have evidence for this, but if that had been put to the vote in Russia, so on the 22nd of February, 2022, Russians could weigh in. Do you wish to have Russia invade Ukraine or not? I think 95% of Russians, including many in the Kremlin and in the military, would have said absolutely not. We don't need this. It's not, you know, for our gain. These are our neighbors. We shouldn't do this. It's not right. It's not a war that we want. That's my instinct, although, you know, again, evidence would be helpful on this point. But it doesn't matter because it's an autocracy. And, you know, it's not even an autocracy. It's a dictatorship by 2022. And the dictator can do it. Once he does it, it's very hard for countries to sort of say that they're wrong and to pull out. Any criticism of the war now is criminalized in Russia. And Putin has been able, through his media apparatus and other tools, to bring the population around and sort of put it behind the war. But the dictatorship is a necessary ingredient here. Without that, I don't think that you have the war and you don't have the, you know, sort of the catastrophe that you're seeing, that we're all seeing before our eyes.
Well, we need to start wrapping things up, but I wanted to make certain that I asked you this question. As I said in the introduction, for 2 years, you served on the Secretary's policy planning staff at the U.S. Department of State, where you held the Russia-Ukraine portfolio. First of all, what does that mean?
Well, the Office of Policy Planning is about 20 people, and they have regional and functional portfolios. So a functional portfolio would be, you know, arms control or climate change, something that spans many different regions. And then the regional portfolios are just, you know, what they would seem. And, you know, what you do in that job is you try to pass good quality information up to your boss. You try to think about coordination. How does the U.S. coordinate its foreign policy across different regional and functional axes? And you also try to generate new ideas to the extent that you can about, you know, how do we look at these things? What might be opportunities or pitfalls for the secretary in the secretary's travel? Sometimes it's speech making, and sometimes it's the policy making stuff that happens at the White House. And so you're just trying to, on the one hand, make U.S. policy as efficient as possible. You know, that which has already been decided, you try to think about making that operative. And then you also think about where U.S. policy might be getting things wrong or where there might be a need for new ideas and new departures. So you do your best in those kinds of jobs to meet those taskings.
So at a, I mean, at a relatively minor level, you were a participant observer of some of these events. When you, did you come in? We should talk about, I realize now the importance of February 2014, that in fact, February is going to be a really important month in Ukrainian history in the future. But the Yanukovych's attempt to suppress the Maidan, what was it called? The basically the revolution of the Maidan.
We right now think right. of it,
right? With sniper fire, with some sort of gunfire, with some kind of violence, fails miserably, and he makes his ignominious exit stage right. And were you present at the State Department at that time? You were not witness to that, but you were witness to what happened after that.
I got
so,
it.
But yet,
December of 2014 is when I started.
Okay. And yet I don't see you refrain from any – I looked in vain for any of the perpendicular personal pronoun. I saw no I in the book. So you weren't describing what was going on in the State Department for those 2 years, which are crucial years in the – development of the Ukrainian-American relationship. I realized when you hear Ben Hodges or other commanders of the United States Army Europe, they were the only people unsurprised by the performance of the Ukrainian army. And I quickly realized that was because they knew more about it than anyone else, other than Ukrainians, probably because they'd had so many contacts with it.
Right.
They were very well informed on it. So you were at the beginning of that from the State Department, at least. You're an observer of those, that increase of contacts.
So there's a little bit of eye on the book, in the preface.
Okay.
And it does sort of begin with one experience that I had in the State Department, and this was a trip that we made to Kyiv in January of 2016. And we had a bunch of official meetings, which were interesting enough, but at the same time kind of forgettable because you hear what you expect to hear. But the embassy set up a meeting with students from Kyiv Mohyla Academy and Taras Shevchenko University, the two elite universities in Kyiv. And this was just remarkable. They were so bright. They were so interesting. They were so interested in democracy. We ended up talking about Tocqueville and voluntary associations and sort of what democracy means in the fullest sense of the word. And these students left a great impression on me. When you leave the State Department, you no longer have access to your email. So I kept in touch with a few of them when I was there, but no longer can I do so. And I just think of them now as on the front lines of this war. And to me, this is not a policy relevant point, but it's just a human relevant point. When I think of Ukraine, I often think of these people and their kind of destinies and where life will take them. So I do have a, you know, sort of a personal investment, I would say. And I'm sure that that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, but it's not something I write much about in the book. I think that the policymaking experience, at least I can say for me in terms of what it did with the book, is gives me empathy for how hard it is to make policy. Things come at you very fast. You don't have the context that you need. And these are big, you know, institutions, the State Department, the intelligence community. It's very, very hard to do things well. And there's a lot that I admire in the work that my office and the State Department was trying to do. I think that every effort that the U.S. made on reform in Ukraine, you know, democracy, elections, rule of law, you know, none of it was 100% successful, but all of the effort that was made helped to bring Ukraine to Zelensky and to the 2019 election in Ukraine, which is democratic, and Poroshenko, the president, who's not, you know, a great reformer himself, but he does leave power peacefully. And all of that, I think, is necessary for Ukraine to survive and endure in 2022. So I think there's something that we did that is important. But I also feel like we got a lot wrong analytically, and that we really underestimated how much Russia was invested in trying to take over Ukraine. We underestimated how canny Russia is as an international actor. We can talk about all the ways in which their military has failed in Ukraine, but Russia is keeping markets open, and weapons are flowing into Russia. There's more arms production in terms of shells at the moment in Russia than there is in the West, and that's showing its results on the battlefield. And that's something that we just consistently underestimated, looking at Russia as kind of backwards and something of a loser of a country. And if we just nudge it enough with sanctions, we'll get it to play ball. So in that sense, I do want to work through all of this. I want to understand the challenges of policymaking. It's not for me to stand there in retrospect and to criticize, but I do want to elucidate some of these analytical shortcomings and try to explain why they were there. And in the conclusion to, you know, to suggest that we need to move beyond this and get to a different analysis.
And
I think our policy is better.
That John McCain joke that Russia's a gas station with nuclear weapons, wasn't that it? That's double-edged. Having an endless supply of gasoline and nuclear weapons is actually also a very powerful – those are two very powerful advantages. And you can see the way that Lavrov can use petro-diplomacy and lying a lot. But those are two very powerful diplomatic cards to play.
We pay a big, very high price for those kinds of jokes because they distract us from what's really important. And, you know, to sum up, as I know we're trying to do at the moment, you know, collision's only gestures at this, but we've gotten to the subject, I think, in a nice way in our conversation. For 300 years, Russia has been a part of Europe. For the next 300 years, Russia is going to be a part of Europe. The question is not whether Russia is a part of Europe. The question is how Russia is a part of Europe, whether they're a gas station upper Volta with nukes, you know, fill in the blank in terms of the descriptor that used for Russia. It is going to be a part of the European story. And that's what we're seeing play out before our eyes on the battlefields of Ukraine. But of course, there's a huge amount of history behind this. So we need to link that history to what's happening on the battlefield. And I think if we do, the U.S. will get at a a sort of better, smarter policy position.
Well, you must have read my notes, because that's exactly where we're supposed to end. With my enduring preoccupation, can we actually learn from history? That is, in fact, the dedication of your book. You dedicate to your daughters, which is nice. They no longer will be teased by the children of other professors. This actually happens on Oxford playgrounds, I have been reliably informed. But can we learn from history? You have a great – it's wonderful. There's some wonderful epigrams in the book and insights. But you write on 224 in the conclusion, you write – I'm going to quote there, read the entire paragraph. Countries invariably conceive their foreign policies in reaction to earlier conflicts. They are led by their sense of who is wrong and who is right, of what the core problem was and what the solution to that problem was, fighting the last war until it is no longer the last war. This preoccupation with the past can be the path to wisdom, to learning from history, or it can leave countries trapped in their interpretations of the past. To investigate the origins of an ongoing war, then, is not just to chart the present moment. It is to peer, however uncertainly, into the future. Let's stick with that. This is the problem, isn't it? The preoccupation with the past. It can be a path to wisdom, or it can leave countries trapped in their interpretations of the past.
So
both of us, if we had $10 for every time we've talked about appeasement, we could split it and be comfortably wealthy. You know, that we've heard people use analogies of appeasement. They obscure more than they illuminate.
Yeah.
I'm sure in the 1930s they were citing something else. But let's end with that.
Sure. So in this passage, I'm trying to chide both the United States and Russia in different ways. I think Russia blew a huge opportunity after 1991. Russia never had such a peaceful Europe to work with. There is no intent to invade. We spoke about the strategic significance of Ukrainian territory. That's well and good, but what are the threats out there? And the threats from Europe were basically nil. The United States, you know, damages Putin's vanity and ego with some of the things that it does with NATO, but the United States also has no intent to disrupt or to harm Russia as such. And in that sense, Russia had a lot to work with. So Russia's preoccupation with the past, with invasion, you know, with its security problems, became an obstacle, I think. You know, it's something that Putin would instrumentalize, exploit to stay in power, to acquire power, to use power. But it goes beyond that. I think his own preoccupation with the past is very unhealthy. And it doesn't lead to wisdom in his case, but has led to the folly and to the crime of this war, which is going to be a stain on Russia for decades, if not for centuries. And it's just a tragedy for everybody involved, Ukrainians first and foremost, but for Russia, for Ukraine, and for Russia, for Europe, and for the United States. So in that sense, there's a sort of missing historical wisdom that's there, or refusal to learn the right lessons from the past. That's unbelievably sad to contemplate. But the U.S., it's almost the opposite problem. The U.S. was so sanguine about Europe. Europe whole, free, and at peace. That was the phrase that we used for our Europe policy from George Bush Sr. All the way down to Barack Obama and beyond in some cases. How is it that we thought that Europe was going to sort itself out? Eastern Europe and Central Europe has never sorted itself out. This place is a battlefield for the last 300 years. That's not deterministic. It doesn't mean it's only a battlefield or has to be a battlefield. But is it likely to become a battlefield? Well, history would suggest that it is. And we just ignored that. We blew past that and failed to learn the right lessons in that regard. So Russia and the United States failed to learn the correct lessons from the past. It doesn't put equal blame on them for this conflict. Russia is to blame. But we're in this situation in part because of the uses and abuses of history. So, Al, I would say we have our work cut out for us.
My guest today has been Michael Kimmage. His most recent book is Collisions, The Origins of the War in Ukraine and the New Global Instability. Michael, thanks once again for being on Historically Thinking.
Such a great pleasure, Al. Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks so much to you as well for being part of Historically Thinking. If you like the podcast, you can, of course, give us a review on the podcast platform of your choice. But by far the best way of helping us out is to share the podcast with a friend or with many friends. George McDonough is our producer. John Rutta is our sound engineer. I'm Al Zambone, and I'll be back with more history to think about and to shape the way we think about the present.